I don't wanna go to work. I just wanna chill and play all day. Look him dead in the face and say, I wish I could just be still asleep while you work.
Welcome back to the Jobs Blow podcast. I'm your host, Brianna Haas, here once again to share more inspiring stories about getting ahead. This week's show is called How to Fight Back If You've Been Sacked, with author and attorney at law, Stephen Mitchell Sack. How are you today, Stephen?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. And your last name, Sack, I was like, all right, I have to get really creative with this because it's so relevant to our conversation. So,
yeah, I was once interviewed by the San Francisco Chronicle. They were the first ones and said, you're Sack, said author Sack. You know, they caught that. It's pretty amazing, right, that a lawyer that represents fired executives, that's his last name.
It is perfect. And it makes me wonder, was this destiny for you? Like when you were born, was your father like, look, I've gifted you this name. There's only one way to go? Or
actually, yeah. I mean, believe it or not, it's crazy. I mean, I didn't put it all together, but let me tell you a little bit about my background. My father of blessed memory was a commissioned salesman. He worked in the garment center in New York City. He was a multi-line sales rep. And when I was growing up, he was always getting screwed. He would build up a territory. The companies would take away an account, call it a house account. He'd get a huge deal, let's say like a $1 million order. And they'd say, Bernie, guess what? You were making 10%, but we can't pay you 10% on such a large order. We're going to give you 5%. I mean, things like this happened all the time to him and his cronies. So growing up with my father, you know, he was very indignant and he believed in justice. And so when I was in law school, he sued a couple of companies. They called him Sue'em Sack, and he won. And I worked on those cases with the local law firms that represented him. And I knew a lot about salesmen and their issues because of growing up with a salesperson father. And I went to law school, and my dad made me write a book for salespeople called The Salesperson's Legal Guide, which I got independent study my last year at Boston College Law School. This is back in 1978, long time ago. And the book was accepted by Prentice Hall. It comes out in 1980, and bingo, here I am starting my own firm representing commissioned salespeople and also representing people in all walks of life, you know, jobs. I started representing people that were fired. And in 1984, got my big break. An article came out in the Wall Street Journal. It said, many middle managers are fighting back. Someone had told them about a case that I had. 15 people had been fired, and I represented 7 of them. And I got the 7, like, huge severance increases. And that was it. And then I started representing people on Wall Street, banks, hedge funds, and the word got out. And now about 15,000 cases later, all I do all day long is represent fired employees and executives, get them better deals. It's worked. So yes, whether it was karma, fate, or whatever, I really owe it all to my father of blessed memory. And everything I do is always, you know, I think of him. He taught me integrity and honesty. And I'm almost 69 now. I've been practicing for 42 years. I've also, I don't want to boast, but if people look me up, they'll see I've won many multi-million-dollar breach of contract and discrimination jury verdicts. Recently, Scott Lucas, my litigator that works with me and myself, we won a $6.2 million jury verdict in the Bronx on behalf of 3 pregnant women who were fired unfairly. I mean, this is all I do all day long.
And do you think that you were all inspired because of what you saw your dad go through?
Totally. I didn't get to see my father. I loved him dearly. And in high school, during the summers, he was a traveling salesman. So he would go from Maine down to Washington. And I went with him. I would sit in the car. We talked for hours about fighting back and breach of contract and oral contracts. I mean, this was on his mind. It was like he was directing me in my own way. I mean, he didn't know I'd be a lawyer. I had to do well in college, which I did. I got straight A's, and my last 3 years I was going to be a doctor. And then I got a D in organic chemistry. That was it for me. And then I went into the other area of law and got straight A's, Phi Beta Kappa, whatever. And then I got into a very fine law school. And then we knew that my destiny was going to be to work with people to help them. You know, and I love the employment arena because I work on a contingency fee, But better than a personal injury lawyer where I'm not dealing with people's lives that have been, you know, maimed. I'm dealing with people who have money issues, which is a little bit more palatable for me. Although, you know, when you're fired, it's a very traumatic time, especially if you have an expensive home and you have a mortgage to pay for and two kids in college and your wife is ill and you need to cover her medical coverage, you know. And, you know, COBRA these days is like $4,000 a month, and you may not have the money to afford to be able to do that. So it's very serious. And the implications of, you know, I help so many people every day get a better deal so they can pay their bills and move on until they find gainful employment.
All right. Well, I want to talk more about that. I want to talk about when is the right time to talk to a lawyer like you, and when should you just accept being laid off? But before we do that, I always share a quote that I've picked out that's relevant to the show. Now, when I picked this quote out, I picked it just based on lawyers in general. Okay. So yep. Not necessarily about you, but the quote is, a lawyer with a briefcase can steal more than 1,000 men with guns. And
that's very true.
That's Mario.
And I'll tell you another thing. A bad lawyer can ruin a good case. Okay. But a good lawyer can win a bad case. All I could tell you is, in my career, when I get an escrow check and I put it into my escrow account, I wouldn't take a penny of it. I don't care if I was groveling on the street and had nothing to eat. It really depends on the person that you're dealing with. I'm fortunate. I've represented thousands of people. And if you read my Google reviews and Avvo and Yahoo, all that, you'll see that I only have 5-star reviews because I keep my word. I get right back to people. There's no chicanery. Every time someone hires me, I send them a retainer letter in writing, which spells out exactly what I'm going to do for them. And then I do everything I promise. While I cannot guarantee results, I guarantee effort and skill. When I bill clients on an hourly basis, they get a retainer letter. They get a billing statement later on, which if I'm on the phone with you for 5 minutes, you get billed for 5 minutes. I know a lot of lawyers, they'll say, oh, negotiations with opposing counsel, telephone conversations with Brianna, client, 3 hours, right? And at $600 an hour, if the lawyer had a 5-minute phone call but billed you for 15 minutes, you wouldn't know. And that's stealing. Well, they could live by their conscience, but I can't live like that. So I'm overly protective of my clients, and that's who I am. And probably that's why I have a pretty successful practice.
Well, one thing I want to ask you before we really jump into it is I've had lawyers on this show previously, and one thing that they had in common that they both mentioned is that they liked theater. And that was one of the reasons they became lawyers, that they really love being in front of people and feeling like they were on stage. Was that at all your personality, or was it?
It is. Believe it or not, it is. And I could tell you, in high school, I was in all my shows. In law school, I sing like Sinatra, all of me, you know. So I had a booze cruise on Saturday nights that I sang in a jazz band around Boston Harbor. I put myself through law school that way. So yeah, I'm an entertainer, but certainly quite serious. And it's never about me. It's about actually keeping my promises to people. Like if I tell you I'm going to call you at 5 a.m, you're going to get a call at 5 a.m. It's just who I am. It's in my DNA. My wife knows that the law is a jealous mistress, and most of my day and night it's spent with clients, not with her. But she's accepted that, and weekends that I still work, every free moment I spend with her and my grandkids and all that, and my kids. But bottom line is, you got to be pretty disciplined, and you got to be really committed to being successful.
Well, and before we started the show, I mentioned to you that when I created the Jobs Blow podcast, it was coming from a much different place than what the show is now. And that place was me having just been laid off and really unhappy. So this would be a different conversation if you were my first guest. But on that note, how would you advise people who have been laid off? When is the right time to speak to a lawyer like yourself? Or when is it, okay, you got what you're owed, you need to just move on?
Well, first of all, every firing is negotiable. I'm going to repeat that. Every firing is negotiable. Whenever you get fired, first analyze why you were fired. What did the company tell you? Did they fire you suddenly through no fault of your own, expecting you to bow your head and shuffle your feet out the door? Were you close to a year-end bonus that you were expecting, or the vesting of a pension or profit-sharing plan, or stock options, or did you work hard and expect a commission, but they're terminating you before the customer pays the order? These are all simple. To me, they're simple because examples of unfair terminations. Millions of them occur every year. And also, you don't necessarily need a lawyer to speak with or to go back in and negotiate. That's why I wrote the book Fired, because in the book, there are sample letters to send, what to say, checklists, things like that. Obviously, there's an old expression, she who represents herself has a fool for a client. But the answer is, anytime that you're terminated, you might want to confer with a lawyer, but it's not any lawyer. I mean, I don't know anything about real estate law, criminal law, bankruptcy. All I know is labor and employment. So what you want to do is find in your state a lawyer that represents at least more than 50% of his or her time in representing plaintiff employees. You know, a lot of lawyers, they work for big firms. Both of my sons do. One works for an employment firm and one works for a defendant's employment firm, defending companies who are sued allegedly for discrimination and breach of contract. You need to speak to a specialist. So that's the first thing. But like I said before, question the timing. If it's late November and you're terminated, why were you terminated? What are you owed? What are you expecting? And many times companies will just expect you to just leave and take the first deal, hoping that you're not going to take the bait. Now, if you're a female, if you're a person of color, if you're over, let's say, 60, if you're pregnant, what I recommend is in those situations, the company is probably going to give you a separation agreement with a release contained in it. And you need to have a lawyer look at that to see if the language is acceptable. The point is that most companies, when they fire people, especially people who have been there for more than a year, and I'm not talking about someone that's fired for punching somebody out or drinking on the job. I'm talking about someone who was fired just because of job restructuring, a job elimination, a layoff. If you're going to get a separation agreement and a release or a severance agreement, you really need to have a lawyer look at it. There may be clauses in there that are unfair, like they want you to not work for a competitor in exchange for getting the money for a year, or solicit customers, or you're not allowed to speak negative about the employer, but you would like a mutual non-disparagement provision so that they won't speak poorly about you. You could put in a clause that says if a prospective employer calls, the company will only confirm your dates of employment positions held. You want to negotiate a favorable letter of reference. I believe shorter is better, something like, to whom may concern, Brianna worked here from blank to blank as a blank. She performed her services competently, and we wish her well in her endeavors. So you see, there's so many things to explore and to negotiate, of course, including the financial component of the deal.
Well, and it's funny because I'm staring at your book, which is called Fired, as you mentioned, and that came out this year, correct?
Actually, it came out, the pub date is 2 days ago. It's brand new.
So I'm staring at it and the title Fired with an exclamation point. I have been laid off. So when I see the word fired, I want to get your perspective. Is there a difference? Because when I see fired, it makes me feel really bad. Laid off right. Makes me feel less bad. But is that them just like...
It's a misnomer. It means the same thing. Fired, terminated, separated, laid off, downsized. It's the same legal consequence. You're no longer on the payroll and you're getting screwed.
Right. But to your point, if someone punches somebody, then the fired seems to go with that, right? But if
absolutely,
if you're telling me, oh, we have to let you go because we've lost clients, blah, 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 that feels more laid off.
Well, the caveat is one is a termination for cause and one is a termination not for cause.
Okay. Makes
the
sense.
The cause is stealing, beating someone up, insubordination, not calling in when you're out on a sick day, willfully disrespecting the company's requests or orders. That's a termination for cause. And I don't represent people who were terminated for cause. I mean, they're bad people. I don't want to go to a company and ask for money or more money when they did anything wrong. But let's go the reverse. This person that's working 20 years for a company and last year made them a lot of money. They merged. They set up a new division. And they're laid off suddenly through no fault of their own. And they have two kids in college, like I said. And they offer them a 5-week severance pay, just threw them something. That person should not sign that agreement without conferring with an experienced labor and employment attorney.
So this is pretty relevant right now. What are your thoughts on the Twitter firings? Have you heard from any of them? Because it's
Actually, I have not. And I wouldn't represent them. You know why? Because if 3,000 people are fired en masse, despite my reputation and knowledge, it's going to be very difficult for me to improve their offer. They might pay me a $300 discounted one-hour consultation, which I charge, just to go over the language in their agreement and explain it to them. But I would probably decline representing them because I probably would not be able to improve the offer. But in situations where you're fired in a one-on-one, or a couple of people are fired, I mean, I take those cases literally every day, and more than 80% of the time improve the offer, either or in financial improvements and language to the agreement to make it more powerful and fairer for a person. For example, there are some agreements, most of them these days, that say there's a clause in there that you will cooperate fully in the event the company is sued, not about you, but, you know, and you're going to help the lawyers. I mean, you're like a slave. I mean, I say to the company, my client will cooperate for 3 hours. And after 3 hours, she's going to get paid her reasonable per diem or hourly fee, and you're going to reimburse her for her costs and expenses. Do you know that more than 50% of the time I get that clause inserted in the agreement? And you wouldn't know that, but, you know, that's the kinds of things that we talk about. That's why every firing truly is negotiable.
So you had mentioned that you had won a case recently with the three women that were
pregnant. Yeah, well, when you say recently, it was, I think it was 2016 or 17. It was about 5-6 years ago, something like that.
Well, that seems like yesterday to me. But
well, it was pre-COVID, that's for sure. And let me tell you, I spent the whole summer trying that case in the Bronx. I mean, I think that case started in like early July and it ended late August. I mean, it was quite a hard-fought victory, so to speak. Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
My question to you is, do you feel that you're seeing more of those type cases now because women are coming forward more about it happening to them?
That's a great question. But I think you're talking more about sexual harassment where women are coming more.
No, because I've heard of three different women in my industry who were laid off while they were on maternity leave. Like, I feel like I've heard this quite often, actually. So,
well, first of all, let me tell our listeners that whenever you're pregnant, don't be embarrassed. Run around the hall, scream out, "I'm pregnant, I'm pregnant." Tell everybody at the company, including HR. You know why? Because if you tell the company that you are pregnant, you're in a protected class, and they cannot retaliate or demote you or transfer you or reassign you or fire you like many companies do. So a lot of companies, they go, "Well, we terminated the Susan. We didn't know she was pregnant." They kind of knew, but the minute they suspected it, that like they looked at her stomach and they thought it was bulging a little, or maybe a coworker told the HR person, "Hey, you know," but Susan didn't tell the company directly, and they try to get, you know, around that by firing them immediately. You want to avoid that situation. But women have a lot of rights these days. Like, another hot area is equal pay. Women, there's federal and state laws now that protect women from working in a company where they're being paid less than a similarly situated male colleague. So that's a fascinating area. And then I was referring to the Me Too movement. Up until a couple of years ago, women were afraid of coming forward and complaining about sexual harassment. Scott Lucas and I also had a huge case once, fairly recently, where a woman pre-Me Too movement, I think it was 2017, where she was forced to submit to her boss's sexual appetites and horrible things. And you should see, we had the deposition. I mean, the other side, they like grueled her like she was like, she had asked for it, she wanted it. I mean, it was disgusting. And we won a lot of money in the end, but she went through a lot. But that wouldn't happen 5 years later, post Me Too movement. Now, if you denigrate or try to attack the veracity of the complaining witness, you're going to look really bad, especially in front of a jury. So things have really changed dramatically, favorably for women in all those areas that you alluded to, pregnancy, and then equal pay and sexual harassment.
So when a company lays someone off when they're on maternity leave, and they obviously know it's wrong, someone told me once that they know that what they're going to have to pay out for doing it is less than what they feel they are losing with that person being on maternity leave.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, people don't call me and say, hey, Mr. Sack, how's the flounder fishing season? They call to tell me that they were fired when they're out of maternity leave. I've had cases where the minute the client told the boss that she was pregnant, where she was on a fast track, at one case at a bank, they thought that she was going to be like a big star. And then she had some issues when she became pregnant. And then she took a short-term disability leave because she was having bleeding and stuff while she was pregnant. She thought she was going to be coming back to her same job, and she got gaslighted and she never got that job. Scott Lucas and I thought that the company violated the law, and we had litigation concerning it. So the answer is it's very, very, very problematic why companies do the things that they do, but they're not your friend. And if you think that HR is your friend, you are typically mistaken. I've had lawsuits where I've represented people where I've deposed or in court cross-examined the HR people. I'll give you an example of one case where a woman was gay, and she was in a room with her boss and a coworker, and the boss and the coworker were watching baseball, and the boss said something to her like, hey, how come you're not watching this? She says, I don't like baseball. And he says, really? I thought all gay women love baseball. And she went to HR and complained. So what did the HR person under oath say? Well, I asked the boss if he said it. And he said, no, I never said that. Did she ask the coworker who was in the room, who was happy to tell her that what he heard? No, she conveniently forgot that. The company looked like a horse's ass, and I was able to settle for a huge amount of money, many millions of dollars in court. Bottom line is, I wouldn't trust HR because most of them are really in cahoots with management to try to protect the company at all times. So it's all this stuff is in the book. I mean, I talk about this, and I just want people to know, like, let's say you make a complaint to HR. So many times this happens. And I say, I feel I was mistreated. I was discriminated against because I'm black. And I complained to HR about, oh, how did you complain? Oh, I told them. I said, did you put anything in writing? They go, no. Well, what happens is HR will deny it. Oh, she didn't really say that. She came into the office and we talked about the weather. You know, unless you have it in writing, unless you can prove what you complained about, you're going to diminish the strength of your case. So always put things in writing, maintain a diary I talk about in the book, because sometimes, you know, you can use your diary to recollect events a year or two later. Like, let's say you're in a cubicle and your boss comes over and says, Brianna, you know, let's say you're 64 years old. Brianna, we're looking for some young blood around here. I don't think you're working your territory like you used to. Well, if you can write down those words and remember when it was said and whether there were people around the cubicle who heard it, even months or years later, if you bring an age discrimination case, that diary, you may not be able to introduce the diary, but it can use it to refresh your recollection. So it's always a good idea to write everything down, keep a diary, complain in writing. In Fired, if you remember, towards the end of the book, I have about 20 letters for people to send. So if you're terminated and you're owed overtime or minimum wage or vacation pay or expenses, or a lot of things, I have a separate letter that you can adapt to send to the company to demand those benefits. And the reason why you do that is because if the company doesn't respond to the letter in good faith, many states have laws that say if you prevail in a case, you can get double or triple damages by proving that the company willfully neglected to pay you what you were rightfully owed. So always use letters and documents and emails to preserve and protect your case. One other point I wanted to tell people, if you are being mistreated and you resign, you should, in your resignation letter, state the reason for the resignation. And I am hereby resigning effective immediately. I am owed $26,000 in commissions. I've repeatedly asked for it. The company has refused to pay it, not giving me an explanation. And I intend to contact the Department of Labor to enforce my rights. Those are the kinds of things you would put into a resignation letter. Also, if you're about to get fired and you get a performance improvement plan, right? Many of those plans are subjectively unfair or factually incorrect. You must write a rebuttal. You just shouldn't say refuse to sign it like a lot of people do. You have to sign it and say simple, respectful rebuttal attached. And then you have to explain why many of the comments in the PIP are subjectively unfair or factually incorrect. So this is what my father taught me, Brianna. Mm-hmm. He was the first one. I'll give you a crazy example. Most of the time, salespeople in the 60s and the 70s got hired on a handshake. Now, Samuel Goldwyn, the famous movie producer, once said, a handshake is only worth the paper it's written on. My father figured out how to fight back. Here's what he did. Dear Jim, it was a pleasure meeting with you. Please treat this letter as our agreement. I shall work as is, and it lays out everything. And at the bottom of the letter, he wrote, if any term in this letter is ambiguous or incorrect, please advise. Otherwise, this letter shall set forth and be an accurate reflection of our intentions. He would send that certified mail or hand deliver it, proving delivery. Bingo. Those letters would serve as a valid contract.
Seems like your dad had the law gene.
Oh, he was a genius when it came to that. You know, he understood how important the law is in everybody's life. And he just drove that home to me to the nth degree. I mean, I got to tell you, I love the law personally. I mean, forget about what I do in it. Every day is fascinating. You're helping people. You're fighting for justice. I wake up sometimes 5 a.m. at my age, and I can't wait to go to work because I really affect people positively. And when I negotiate with opposing counsel and HR people, I know how to do it. Most lawyers, they'll, I want $1 million for my client. Bull. Most of the companies have legal defense. They're not going to accept that. But when you talk nicely and you appeal to corporate decency and fair play, and you say, you know, my client, Brianna, as you know, is very well liked. She's been at the company for 20 years. She's 62. She's got arthritis. This is probably her last hurrah. We appreciate your offer of 5 weeks, but after taxes, it's really not much. And based on the contributions, and then I lay them out, this is what I think she's entitled to.
Stephen, why are you using me in ageism instead of sexual harassment? I feel attacked. Just kidding.
The bottom line is, they don't want you to sue them. I mean, that's the underlying problem here. So if they can throw you a couple of bucks, and I'm not saying every case I get another $100,000 for somebody. I mean, I've settled like in the last month and a half, like 20 matters, let's say. And I have a sheet where I'm waiting for my fees and the money for the settlements to come in. Some of my fees are $1,700, which means I got someone another $5,000. My fee is $4,000, which means I got someone $12,000. I mean, I'm not saying that we're going to get huge sums of money. Now, we do when there's an egregious mistreatment of somebody that's illegal. But most of the time, these cases are settled, but it's important that you stand up for yourself, you recognize that every firing is negotiable, and you go back in and you ask for more. I must get, like, let's say 700 people a year literally come to me to represent them in a termination case, right?
Right.
Do you know I only accept like 4 in litigation? Because it's got to be like really big. It's got to be strong. It's got to be airtight. I have to like you as a witness and believe in you. There's a lot of things that go into it. I'm not going to go to war for someone that's got like nonsense or a small matter, you know?
Right.
I'm going for a case that's worth many millions of dollars, and I have to go to a jury and request punitive damages, et cetera. That's the difference between me. I mean, I don't need the money anymore. I only take cases that are big and that are important and that I can win and that I believe in the client.
What kind of cases do you think do you get the most of when you're dealing with wrongful termination? Do you see more of the harassment, the being laid off because they're
it's all in the pot. I mean, I represent people who are owed overtime and unfair wages. commission cases. I have cases where I sue companies because they breached the contract. I mean, I've represented executives. One executive had a clause in his contract that said if he resigned for a good reason, he'd be entitled to a total year of compensation, which was about $750. They put him out to pasture and they took away his responsibilities, but they gave him a modest raise and they claimed that his resignation for a good reason was not valid. And of course, that was nonsense. And I went to arbitration and I won exactly the year and legal fees. So, you know, there's so many things. I mean, I've had a career. I went to the Court of Appeals with Scott Lucas and we won. Tens of thousands of waiters are now getting a lot more money in tips and gratuities because companies were taking the money intended for the wait staff and calling them service charges. I mean, that's a huge case that's changed the law in New York. It's Samiento versus World Yacht. We got a unanimous reversal on the law. Cases come and go all day long. I'm representing now a gentleman who was run over in a factory by a forklift driver, broke his tibia. He's out on his back. Company wants him back immediately. He can't. They fire him, you know, and I'm suing the company right now for damages. And the depositions are going on as we speak. Every case is different.
And do you tend to settle before trial or do you find you go to trial as much as you
do? No, very, very rare does a person go to trial. What I'll tell you is that it's an interesting process. Usually the defense in a big case, and Scott Lucas and I, we spend hundreds of hours preparing our complaint before we file it because it's got to be like really, really factually strong. Mm-hmm. And then usually the other side will ask for a mediation like fairly quickly into the case. And we'll have a certain number and they won't come near it and we'll reject it, right? Then there's the discovery part of the case where we get all the documents, the emails, and we have depositions. And we depose the HR person from the company, and we depose the owner who made the nasty statements, and we read millions of emails, which totally destroy the company's credibility, right? And then at the deposition, the witness for the company, the boss, is saying, well, I didn't really mean that in the email. You know, words have different meanings. It's like, okay, I'd love for jury to hear that. And then they come back and all of a sudden where they please, can we have another mediation, right? And where I would have taken $1 million, but they offered me $400, now after discovery, I won't take a penny under $2 million and they'll pay it. That's the way it works. It's a dance.
And do you find that you represent people from one industry more than any other, or it's pretty diversified?
It's all over the world. Advertising, banking, Wall Street, it doesn't matter. They come to me all day long. They read my book, let's say. I've written 20 books. I wrote a book for women called The Working Woman Legal Survival Guide that was published by Prentice Hall. I wrote a book, The Employee Rights Handbook, which has sold a couple hundred thousand copies. You know, it's in all libraries, et cetera. People read my books. People read about me online. And they come to me. Usually, I don't even meet them. I mean, I represent them. They don't even come in anymore. After COVID, I stopped going into my New York Park Avenue office. I represent people by phone. I give them an hour of time. I charge a $300 discounted fee. I don't care if you're making $1 million a year or $60,000 a year. It's the same thing because I believe in giving back to the American public and giving them accurate advice for a very reasonable fee. And then typically I take cases on a contingency fee. There are no fees up front. And if I get more money for them, I get a third of the gross of whatever I got them through my efforts, minus the $300 they paid me. And if I get them more medical, I typically don't charge that. And I have very happy clients because they know I'm fighting for them and we have a commonality of interest. So if, let's say, I strike out, which is not a lot, but you know, it happens, they know that I was trying to make as much money for myself as them. And people don't complain because they didn't pay anything, you know? So it's a great way to practice. I don't get anybody that ever is angry with me because they know that I tried to get them money. And if I didn't get the money, I didn't get money for myself. If you have a profession and people are yelling at you or not happy with you, you're not going to want to like get up at 5 a.m. and work for them. But if you have people that are complimenting you and thanking you and being polite and respectful to you, you'll go to the ends of the earth to help them. And that's right. My philosophy.
Right. So if someone's listening right now and they just got a bad review at work, is there anything that you would recommend that they do moving forward?
Yes, I would ask them to look at the review and again, question the motive. Like a lot of people, they were brought in by a certain person who loved them and worked with them, right? And they got great reviews. And then all of a sudden that person resigned, was fired. And then a new person comes in and I say to people, you lost your rabbi. Mm-hmm. You lost the person that was protecting you. A new person doesn't know anything about you. A new person doesn't care about you. But does a leopard change its spots? No. If you did a great job for one person, why all of a sudden you were getting superb reviews and now all of a sudden the first review from a new boss is you're terrible? You're the worst thing since sliced bread? I don't think so. So you have to look at that review and figure out what are they saying about you and why. And if there's anything in there that's factually incorrect or subjectively unfair, like I said, you should write a rebuttal and submit it to management. You should not allow the company to railroad you and screw you up. Same thing with my father. He never let the people take advantage of him. If they fired him unfairly or they took away his accounts, he fought back. And that's what he taught me. It's just an incredible feeling to do something when you're right or wrong. And that's what I try to do many times a day.
All right. Well, this is the part where we go into our game. Now, I have to ask you how much you know about pop culture, because the game's usually based in pop culture. You watch a lot of television.
Not really.
Not really. Because my game I came up with is who's the bad boss? And I have a variety of TV bosses to see if you could guess which one I'm talking about.
Let's see. Fire away.
You might know the first one. The antagonistic head dispatcher in the 70s, 80s sitcom. Some of his exploits include taking advantage of drunk friends, spying on his employees, stealing from his place of employment, gambling, and bullying the taxi drivers. Definitely not a good boss.
Would that be Taxi?
Yeah. But do you know the boss?
It wasn't Judd Hirsch, was it?
No, I think it was Louis De Palma was his name. And I'm pretty sure it was Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Here's one that, do you have grandchildren?
I do.
Okay. Maybe you know this show. Over the years, this miserly boss has put SpongeBob and Squidward through so much, including forcing them to work all night, becoming delivery fish, almost murdering a health inspector, and never, ever promoting them.
No, that I wouldn't know. I know they love SpongeBob, but I've never watched it.
Okay. Well, it's Eugene Krabs.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And the next one, this would be maybe your kids watched it. Greed rules his soul. Despite being the wealthiest man in Springfield, he desires to continue acquiring riches and build his empire.
The Simpsons.
And what's his name? What's his name?
You know? I don't know. I forget the guy's name.
Mr. Burns.
Yeah, that was cool.
Head of the nuclear power plant.
Yeah, that was cool.
Okay. Here's another one I have. Despite not finishing college, he said he lost all of his money in a pyramid scheme. He lands a job at a paper company where he quickly rises through the ranks and becomes a manager, rewarded for being one of the best salesmen. However, he isn't a great manager as he was a salesman. One of his coworkers even says he lacked critical thinking skills. Any clues?
No.
Paper company, The Office. Michael Scott.
Yeah. No, I thought you were going to tell me one about 9 to 5, right? Remember that movie?
Oh, yeah.
No, that guy was the worst, the sexual harassing, and then they tied him up. And a lot of people in those days, they dreamt that they could treat a horrible boss that way. But now they can, and you can get back legally. And that's the message that I want our listeners and your followers to know that, again, people really, when they're fired, they should not accept it and just bow their head and shuffle their feet out the door. They must think about why they were terminated, what they can do to ask for more, how they ask for more, go back in at the exit interview and improve that deal. Ask for, if you're fired suddenly, ask for notice pay. Try to get 1 month per year in severance. That's the gold standard. Here's one that's easy. If you're out of work and you need, you know, have a family, ask for medical coverage under COBRA that the company pays for, not you. Companies will typically give you that because they know that you don't have any money to pay your premiums, so why can't they help you out? And then analyze if you're close to a bonus for the year. Don't allow them to say, well, we would have paid you the $50,000 bonus that you were expecting this year, but you have to be on the payroll on February 1, the day the bonus is paid. Uh-uh. You chose the timing of the firing in late November, right? I didn't do anything wrong. But for the firing, I would have gotten that money. If you don't give it to me, I'm calling Stephen Mitchell Sack. He'll get it for me. Same thing if you're close to stock options, a pension, try to get outplacement assistance, try to get a favorable letter of reference. All these things are very easy and doable, but you have to have the knowledge of what to ask for and you have to fight back.
Okay, so where can my listeners find your book?
First of all, I know that if they're in New York, they can go to Barnes & Noble's on 5th Avenue and 47th Street. The book is in the business section. It's stacked up on a table. I am so thrilled. They can get it at Barnes & Noble's, obviously, and any distributor, Amazon. They can go to a site, legalstratpub.com, to order it. They can order it by calling me at 917-371-8000 or calling me at that number. That's my 24/7 business line, 917-371-8000, where they can call me. If they have a question, it's my pleasure. I'm not going to charge them, but I'm not going to get into a case, but I can give them a simple answer. They can find out more about me and the book by going to my website, which is stephensack.com or theemployeeslawyer.com. And finally, if people want to send me an email, they could just send it to stephensack, A-T-T-Y, at hotmail.com. Yes, I'm a dinosaur. I still use Hotmail. stephensack, A-T-T-Y, at hotmail.com. Phone number 917-371-8000. Brianna, I really thank you for just sharing all of my things on my head and tips and strategies, and I really appreciate it.
Of course. Stephen, I just have to ask, did you ever have a jingle created for your law firm? Just being a New Yorker, you know?
No.
Thank you so much. This is the Jobs Blow Podcast. We're at jobsblowpodcast.com and on social media at Jobs Blow Podcast. Thank you so much, Stephen. It was nice meeting you.
You better get a lawyer, son. You better get a real good one. You better get a lawyer, son. You better get a real good one. Get yourself a suit and tie and get your hair cut way up high. Get yourself a lawyer, son. You're gonna need a real good one. I got legs, I can walk all the way down the dirt track. I fell down, I got up, I turned around and then I walked back. I walked to the sea, I stood there and looked for a sign. It took time, but it came. I added up and took what was mine.